Catholic Answers Live. My name is Christopher Check. I am president at Catholic Answers. I am sitting in for your usual kinder, gentler host, Cy Kellett, who is having a vacation day with his lovely wife, Missy. Coming up in our second hour today, Tips for Sharing the Faith, featuring our own boy wonder, staff apologist Trent Horn. And bonus, in our first hour, Tips for Sharing the Faith with staff apologist Trent Horn. Trent, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. Though I'll be having my third child. Everyone pray for that. Well, Laura and I should say. Well, Laura's the one going to be really having the baby. We are both expecting the birth of our third child here next month. And I was hoping by the third baby, I wouldn't be the boy wonder anymore.
I don't know, Trent. I think as long as I'm here and you're here, just because of the vast difference in our age, It's probably plus that youthful appearance that you have.
I think I look more kempt recently because I was able to get myself a haircut.
Well, now do tell. Was this on the black market
somewhere? No, it was not. I thought about going to an illegal back alley barbershop here in California, which is why I think Governor Newsom should keep abortion safe and legal. And to my liking, rare. I don't go to them too often. But, you know, I thought about going to a dangerous, illegal back alley barber, but I was asked to give a series of talks in Boise, Idaho last week.
Right.
And so while I was there, I was able to avail myself of all kinds of amenities like haircuts and eating indoors. And it was delightful.
It was a sort of a return to normalcy there in Boise.
Yes, it was normal. I mean, there were a lot more signs selling fishing gear and things like that than I might see down here in California, since I know that's big up there. But otherwise, and potatoes this, potatoes that.
And you were able to help our friends out there at Salt and Light. You were on the show there. Yes, just in case some of our listeners were a little confused, Trent does not, in fact, hope that Governor Newsom keeps abortion safe and legal here.
No, that is my jest that haircuts. I believe if there is a procedure that is not designed to kill a human being, like cutting their hair, which is good for their mental well-being, you can get haircuts here, Chris. I've seen some barbers offer them outdoors. You can get them outdoors. You just can't get them indoors. And you hope that your barbershop is right not next to the outdoor patio dining area of the adjacent restaurant.
Right, where your clippings could land in someone's scrambled eggs.
Hopefully not. Yeah. So, but that was wonderful. It was great to be able to go and speak there in Boise, Idaho. I spoke on my new book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? And I actually gave a presentation for the Napa Institute on that question recently.
Oh, they had an online program.
They did, right. Yes. So we were talking about that. And what's interesting, Chris, I wanted to have an observation, but anyone who's thinking of calling in today, open tips for defending the faith. If you would like help, how do I answer this objection? How do I approach this issue?
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH.
Yes, 888-318-7884. I hope you will call in. I brought up a point in the discussions because I think that when I and Catherine Bacalik wrote our book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? We started writing it a year and a half ago. When the book was scheduled to be released, I had envisioned the country be a far different place than it currently is. But actually, a lot of the events that have transpired, I believe, have vindicated the positions that we have taken in the book. One of those being that when it comes to the problems of socialism, a lot of it isn't just economic or even theological. It's anthropological. It's misunderstanding the nature of the human person. So take, for example, the defund the police movement. This idea, and now it means different things to different people. Some will say, we don't literally mean that, to which there was that New York Times editorial a few months ago that said, yes, we literally do mean.
Right. Use defund in a sentence, right?
Exactly. Yeah, what do you mean by that? Get rid of the police. You might say, well, how will we have law and order in society? And these academics who, and this idea, Chris, has been around for a long time, along with the prison abolition movement.
Right.
And the idea from the academics who defend this is that, well, if you just took that money and you put it into communities to eradicate poverty, there won't be crime because it's poverty that makes crime. Mm-hmm. Because human beings are good in their nature, they're good by nature, and it's society that corrupts them, which is an Enlightenment view that is antithetical to the Christian view, which is that we are sinful. We're not totally corrupt like the Calvinists will say, but we veer towards evil. We have a natural predisposition towards it, to concupiscence. And so we need society, primarily religious society, the domestic church and the larger church, and society as a whole, though, to civilize us.
Yes.
And to raise us up from our merely animal nature. Which, by the way, this argument that, well, if you just got rid of poverty, you get rid of crime. I always wonder, yeah, but what about those guys at Enron and Bernie Madoff?
Sure, sure. Well, you know,
they have plenty of money, and yet they're still committing crimes.
Trent, I remember very clearly back from my Rockford Institute days when I had been with them just for a couple of years. I was the editor of a monthly publication called The Family in America, and one of the functions of this monthly was to show how the findings of social science, oddly enough, do support things like the traditional family, mom, dad, children. And I remember coming across one study that showed that the interstate variance, the relationship between the interstate variance and crime, the interstate variance in family breakdown, so for example, divorce and illegitimacy,
right,
and crime, was much more robust than the interstate, the relationship, the interstate variance between the relationship or the of the relationship between poverty,
right,
and crime. So it's in the main, well, all kinds of pathologies we associate with the breakdown of marriage, but crime, of course, is one of them.
Absolutely. A good book on that by David Papineau is Families Without Fathers.
For sure. I knew David. Yeah. Worked with him. Yeah.
It's a classic book on the
subject. And by the way, not exactly someone you would describe as a right winger. Taught at Rutgers, I think.
Well, that's similar. You're seeing a lot of people who are coming out with that view that they are moderate, they're center of the road, even people who identify themselves as liberals, but seeing that they reject, frankly, this Marxist idea of abolishing the family, of seeing the family as a kind of evil unit. Whereas
it's oppressive.
It's oppressive. We should have this pure egalitarianism. The idea is that your moral ties should be equal to every other citizen in society and not just centered within primarily to the immediate members of your own household. Another good book on that that relies on Papineau's research is David Blankenhorn wrote a book called The Future of Marriage.
Yep.
What's interesting about that book is it was one of the best books I read back in the day when it came out, arguing against so-called same-sex marriage. Now, Blankenhorn has changed his view.
Well, he is a liberal.
He is a liberal, yeah. He's changed his view on the matter, but he said, I've changed my view. I think same-sex marriage should be legal, but I don't retract anything I wrote in my previous books. This is purely a pragmatic decision to live and get along with other Americans. But he doesn't detract from anything he talked about the importance of marriage and family.
Right. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I am Chris Check, sitting in for Cy Kellett, and my guest is staff apologist Trent Horn, and we are talking today about how to share the faith, tips of sharing the faith. There you are in conversations. And Trent, I think especially right now when, I mean, this is getting a little tired to say, I apologize, but our country, there is a palpable doesn't even begin to describe it, so obvious divide, and the divide is growing deeper and wider. And many Catholics, even within their own parishes, for example, may be finding themselves in conversations with fellow parishioners, even Sunday Mass goers. The election, of course, that's coming up provides a lot of opportunity for conversation about this, particularly on the question of abortion and can a Catholic politician support abortion? That's a question we can answer fairly quickly.
Yes, there's a lot of important issues that are coming up here, both at the local, state, and national level when it comes to elections. And as Catholics, we always have to remember not all issues are equal. Some issues we can prudentially disagree about. We can disagree about what is the best way to achieve the good. But other issues do involve intrinsic evils or rights that cannot be contravened. So abortion is one. I think, Chris, another example that's going to be coming up soon is the right to educate our children, the right to be able to impart our faith to our children and to bring them up according to the faith, and the right to educate our children, which would include the right to be able to educate children apart from government institutions, that you have the right to not, as long as you can provide an education for your child, you have the right to not allow the state to educate or miseducate them, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's important because, Chris, what we're seeing now is because of the pandemic, there is a huge influx of people who are looking at homeschooling because they see, well, in Los Angeles County, just north of us, the teachers union secured a deal where their teachers are not even required to do video instruction with their pupils. They're just required to spend a set amount of hours per week educating, which can include sending emails.
Mm.
So many parents are saying, well, if that's how it's going to go, I'll just educate my kid if I have to be home.
I can get the reading list.
Yeah, I'll just get a reading list or I'll educate them through courses like Homeschool Connections, which I and Tim Staples, we offer classes.
Sure, our good friends in Texas.
With our friends at Homeschool Connections. And we're seeing a backlash now of states and municipal governments who are penalizing people, withholding funding from them because they're choosing to not return to public schooling. And even you had people at Harvard University. I wrote an article about this a few months ago. Harvard hosted an entire summit, Chris, on the dangers of homeschooling and that there ought to be a presumptive ban against the practice.
Sure.
In the same way, there's a ban against it in Germany and in Scandinavia.
Yeah, yeah. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Of course, Trent, you will be talking about some of these issues. We've got a webinar for our major givers coming up for members of our President's Club and Founders Circle called Faith in the Voting Booth, and that's this Thursday. And anyone who's interested, if you are a member of our Founders Circle or President's Club, you can sign up for that. You'll be getting an invitation if you haven't already. I know some people have signed up. If you're not a member and would like to join, visit givecatholic.com, givecatholic.com, and it'll tell you how to join those two societies. 888-318-7884. We're going to go to a break here, Trent. Before we do, 20 Answers flash sale is underway right now. What would you say if I told you that all of our 20 Answers books were on sale for $1 each? I'm holding up some for those of you who are watching on Catholic.com, YouTube, and Facebook. Hard to believe, but it's true. Visit shop.catholic.com today, where all of the 20 Answers, I think there's almost over 30 in the series now. I can't remember, Trent. All of the 20 Answers books and ebooks are $1 each. That's a savings of 75% on dozens of great titles. Act now. The sale lasts only until Saturday, so less than a week, and then gone in a flash, hence flash sale. Who writes this ad copy? It's brilliant.
It is, and you read it with aplomb.
I do. Back after this.
Catholic Answers Focus has a full day's supply of vitamins and minerals. Get it wherever you get your podcasts or listen anytime at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. This week, Father Hugh Barber joins us to consider what the Catholic Church actually teaches about racism. The term racism was not in use before the 20th century, so you might think that there's no teaching about racism in the Bible or in the tradition of the Catholic Church. Well, there is, and Father Hugh explains it. Then we have Joe Heschmeyer explaining common misconceptions about the papacy that you'll feel a lot better if you get over. And we've got a bonus podcast this week on the Assumption and Coronation of Mary. Catholic Answers Focus is free, brand new twice a week, and now also available on YouTube.
Now, not only can you watch EWTN anywhere, but anytime with EWTN On Demand. Get on-demand access to more than 12,000 EWTN programs, including live shows and specials, all in one place, all free. Just go to EWTN.com/on-demand. There's nothing to fill out, no memberships required, and no fees to pay. All you need is an internet connection, and you're good to go. EWTN On Demand. Fast, easy, and free.
Catholic Answers Live. My name is Chris Check. I am president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett, 888-318-7884, to talk to our guest today, Trent Horn. We're talking today about how to share the faith, tips for sharing the faith. Trent is very good at this. As Trent likes to say, you don't need to have all the right answers. You just need to know how to ask the right questions. Trent, before we go to calls, and we are getting calls here about how to share the faith, we have to wish my mom happy birthday. August 17th is her birthday. I don't think I should say how old. Can I say how old? You're not supposed to tell like the age of a woman.
You can just say she's 29.
Yeah, she's a little, because I'm
a little past 29.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so at our church, when we celebrate birthdays, when we used to be able to do it communally, we would sing God grant him or God grant her many years. I find that to be a wonderful little hymn. God grant her many years. God grant her many years. So a nice alternative to the standard, more secular happy birthday.
Oh, I like that very much. I have to say, because Trent, I don't know if you know this. I sent around an all staff email. My brother, Father Paul Check, was appointed executive director of the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Congrats.
So he's accepted that post. He'll be back and forth between the seminary in for the Diocese of Bridgeport and the Shrine for a year during the transition before he completely moves out to La Crosse. But as you know, he'll be working for Cardinal Raymond Leo Burke. Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke.
Yes. Right?
Exactly. So anyway, my brother convinced His Eminence to call my mom today on her birthday. So she got a call from Cardinal Burke from Rome. Yeah, praise God. Okay, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Anonymous. Anonymous, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello. So my question is about transgenderism and gender confusion.
Sure.
I have a really hard time approaching some of my friends or, you know, coworkers who try and defend this idea. And, you know, I always try and approach this from a loving and respectful way.
Sure.
And I still get called transphobe. I don't know how it happens. But with that being said,
you're in good company.
Oh, yeah. I know.
It's interesting, Trent, the way that word phobia and phobe has been turned and used over the now a couple of generations going.
Yes. Typically, someone who had a phobia was
fearful of something.
Fearful or that, not just fearful, but they had a mental illness or disorder. They had an irrational fear that prevented them from operating normally in life. Now, it could be the case someone has irrational fears of particular kinds of individuals, and so they can't function in this world. But typically how it's used now is it's more of it's a rhetorical conversation stopper.
Right.
It's a way to say, I don't have to engage your position. I can just essentially call you a variant of the word bigot, and that's the end of it. And so Anonymous, I am sorry if people have essentially called you a bigot or, you know, used this word transphobe as a synonym for that. So you're wondering how to address this issue with friends who disagree with you?
And if you don't mind, I want to present three common, things that you hear.
Okay.
So you often hear that sex and gender are two different things. Mm-hmm. You often hear that transitioning can be justified because it can help with the person's mental health. And you also hear something on the lines of, well, as long as the person's happy, who are you to tell them that they ought not transition? So, how do we approach these things from, especially from a non-religious perspective?
This is a really well put together question, Anonymous. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I think Anonymous, first, as just standard guidelines when you're addressing this issue and talking to other people, we have to have compassion and sensitivity. We should make a distinction between individuals who have gender dysphoria, who struggle with their identity of being either male or female and feeling like they're kind of trapped in the wrong body or there's something wrong with their body. We should treat them and have compassion for them in the same way we would have compassion upon someone who has something like anorexia nervosa, someone who looks in the mirror and sees a morbidly obese person when in actuality they may be dangerously underweight. And so they have a distorted view of reality about what their own body actually is. So we should look at that and with compassion, but not encourage destructive, mistaken senses about one's identity. Now, the three points that you raised, first, we can say to someone, I agree with you. The words sex and gender refer to two different things. And you should ask the other people and you're talking to, what do those words mean? What is someone's sex and what is their gender? Typically, sex now the problem is that these words mean different things to different people. One definition that I think makes at least somewhat sense is the idea that sex refers to your biological makeup, the property of being a man or woman, and gender was traditionally, though not always, a property of words. We'd say, not necessarily in the English language, but in Spanish and French, you have masculine and feminine nouns, for example. But gender can also mean just the ways you live out your sexuality according to different social norms and customs. So we have gendered views about work occupations or even colors, which have changed over time. But I wouldn't get lost in the weeds too much on that. But you can agree there's a difference there, but I would backpedal the discussion back to a more core question. And this is a question I have asked transgender advocates. I can never get a straight answer on, and you should ask the same question. obviously you mean that the terms man and woman are not synonymous. They agree that think about it, Chris. Man and woman, they're not synonymous, because if I said a transgender woman is a man, I would be transphobic.
Right.
So clearly the terms man and woman are not synonymous. There is a difference between them. And so I would ask them, what is that difference? What is a man and what is a woman?
I can see how no one wants to answer this question for you, Trent.
It can't be done, because the advocates, what they will do is they'll simply define it by using the very term in the definition, which is fallacious. They'll say, well, a woman is just any human being who identifies as a woman, which is just not a helpful definition at all. You can't use the very term that you're describing right. in the definition you're proposing. So that's a question that you should ask, and I've never gotten a straight answer, because it can't be answered. To say, look, well, what is a man? What is a woman? Clearly these words mean different things. What is the difference between them? And it can't be done unless you use a biological framework. And now you could say that's important when we answer, because you can fall into a trap. Some people, the common answer is, well, a woman's the one that can have babies and the man's the one that can impregnate people. And then they'll say, yeah, but what about infertile people? What we would say is, a woman is someone who is naturally ordered towards gestation, and a man is someone who is naturally ordered towards impregnation, even if they have some kind of an illness or disability, or they have not reached that level in their development to be able to do that, such as, you know, a 4 or a 5-year-old child. But they have that particular nature about them. So that would be one point, Anonymous, that I would bring up. Another point that covers the last two points you raised, which are, yeah, but what about people's mental health? It's good for them to quote-unquote transition. And what I would say is, we should not give in to the language here. A man cannot become a woman. So we should not say, well, sex transition, sex reassignment surgery. We should just say acts of sexual mutilation. This is just mutilation. You're destroying healthy organs and then claiming a person has changed sexes. That's just impossible. Here's an analogy that I would give. There is a particular illness called body identity integrity disorder. It's called BIID. And these are people who are convinced that they are paralyzed, and yet they're ambulatory. They can walk, but they are convinced they're trapped in the wrong body. They believe they are paralyzed. Either they think they can't walk, or they think they're supposed to be amputees. Like Chris, they'll think that their arms aren't really theirs.
Right.
And it's like a phantom arm or an alien arm, an appendage they want to get rid of. And so you'll have people who will go to doctors asking for their spinal cords to be severed, their limbs to be amputated, which are healthy. And they'll say, that conforms to my identity. And of course, any doctor worth his salt will say, no, you have a mistaken sense of who you are. You're actually healthy. You are not paralyzed. You are not an amputee. In good conscience, I cannot damage your body to help you achieve this identity. And so I think that we can compare that, and we could say, look, if you allow this reasoning to justify so-called sex reassignment surgery, it applies just as equally well to body identity integrity disorder. I mean, you go even farther, Chris. You could say, what about somebody who has Cotard delusion? Cotard delusion is when you think you're dead. You think that you're a walking corpse, essentially. You know, should we kill people who have Cotard delusion so they can be the dead people they think they are? No, eventually we cross an absurd point. And then finally, Anonymous, I would bring up this point. When it comes to mental health, you can point out that transgender advocates, that even if you go to countries that are incredibly affirming of this kind of ideology, like in Scandinavia or the Netherlands, there are still high rates of mental illness among people who embrace this ideology, which reflects more the broken elements of the human person that are present here. Is that a helpful reply?
Oh yeah, Trent, you really put the nail in the coffin.
Okay, good.
That's a very good answer, yeah.
I would recommend also, if you would like to go deeper on this subject, a good book on it is by Ryan Anderson. Has the cutesy title, When Harry Became Sally. So not When Harry Met Sally, the film, but it's called When Harry Became Sally, and I forget the subtitle, by Ryan Anderson. I think it's something about the transgender moment, but the book is called When Harry Became Sally by Ryan Anderson. I also covered the issue a little bit in my book with Layla Miller in our book, Made This Way.
Thank you, Anonymous. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I am Chris Check. The show is Catholic Answers Live. I'm sitting in for Cy Kellett. My guest is Trent Horn. And this hour and the next hour, we are talking about how to share the faith, tips for sharing the faith. If you have any question you have in that has come up for you, for example, or you anticipate in conversation, whether it be with an atheist or a non-Catholic Christian, a Protestant, or maybe Jehovah's Witnesses or a Mormon or a Catholic who has not benefited from the fullness of the teaching of the church in the way that you have. Any questions at all about sharing the faith in that regard, please call in and let's get some guidance from Trent. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. The show is Catholic Answers Live, right back after this.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Dr. David Anders. Is God an angry God?
We answer questions like these every day on Call to Communion, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, my friends. I am not Cy Kellett. Cy Kellett is taking Monday off to be with his lovely wife, Missy. My name is Christopher Check. I am president at Catholic Answers. Fear not, Cy will be back behind this microphone tomorrow. The kinder, gentler Cy Kellett with me in studio today. Staff apologist Trent Horn here at Catholic Answers to answer your questions about sharing the faith. Conversations that you've had with fellow Catholics, with non-Catholic Christians, with non-believers, and there's some point of Catholic doctrine or teaching that has come up, and you've been stumped, and we're going to help you work through that. Trent is the guy to do it. Trent, before the break, I mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons because in my experience, of course, I don't have the skills that you do, but they tend to kind of shut down when I try to present to them what are the inconsistencies in their various arguments and whether they be historical changes, for example, in their doctrine or inconsistencies from one document to another. What's your secret there with these peculiarly American kind of religions?
Yeah, and I think the key here, and what I try to do in a lot of my apologetics, in fact, I'm filming a course now for our School of Apologetics, titled To Be Determined, but it'll focus on Socratic apologetics, which is the art of using questions. Like I did notice with the transgender caller here. The caller had a question about transgenderism. A question you should ask the other side. I find that many Catholics neglect this step. Before we can be effective at sharing the good news of the gospel, we have to first make clear to the other person the bad news of what they currently believe.
Right.
So if the person thinks that what they believe is true and consistent and good and produces good effects, they won't give what we say any kind of fair hearing. They'll just say that we're salespeople out to get them. But we have to instill doubt in what they hold first before they'll be receptive to what we want to put forward. So part of that can include pointing out flaws in what people believe, but it can be hard. You're right, with Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, what about this here? What about that here? I find going after the root of the tree. So asking the authority question, I think, is huge.
Right.
Where do you get your authority from? So with Jehovah's Witnesses, getting into, example, in a scripture debate with them can be very difficult because they go to Bible studies every week. They can out-debate people on John 1:1 in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
But I would ask them, well, what is your position? Because
the word was a God.
Right, exactly. But instead of getting into debates about the Greek in John 1:1, I find they often try to present themselves as just another branch of Protestantism. Well, we are Bible students and we just listen to the scriptures. The scriptures are our authority. But I would say to them, well, no, it's not. What should I believe about the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in Brooklyn? Because your teaching is that this is God's organization on earth. So it's not just any other organization. You have a magisterium, essentially, that has authority. And I would just say, where do you... It's similar to when we engage other Protestants. Well, where is your authority to interpret these scriptures come from? Where did the Bible come from? And especially with Jehovah's Witnesses, why should I trust the teachings of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society? Why? So first, give me reasons to think that they are God's organization. So give me evidence for this proposition. And if you can't, that's not good. And then if you want to, at that point, when they cannot provide any evidence for what they believe, you can say, here's also why I am skeptical of the Watchtower. The book of Deuteronomy says a test for a prophet is if a prophet leads people away from worshiping Yahweh or his predictions don't come to pass, you're to reject the prophet.
Yeah, well.
And both of those are the case for Jehovah's Witnesses because they want us to worship Jehovah, who is not a triune God. And then second, they make predictions over and over and over again that have not come to pass. A famous example of that, there is a mansion here in San Diego, actually. That was created in the 1920s.
It was going to house the prophets.
Yes, when the end of the world was near, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were going to be resurrected, and they needed a place to stay. And so they built this huge mansion here in San Diego.
And there was a limousine that they were going to be driven around in.
Yes, and they actually planted olive trees and other trees in the grounds to make the prophets feel more at home. I'm not making this up.
No,
people.
It's true. You can see the building.
Yeah, you can see here. It's a historical landmark. Though when the prophets failed to show up, Joseph Rutherford, who was the president of the Jehovah's Witnesses, just ended up living there during the Great Depression.
It was thoughtful that he picked a place like San Diego with a nice climate.
Well, he wanted something, you know...
Mediterranean.
Right, yeah. Right. And so this is a similar thing you might apply to Mormons to say once again, well, where is your authority ultimately? And what Mormons will do is they just present essentially testimonial. They'll say, read the Book of Mormon or a passage from it, pray about it, and God will confirm whether it's true or not. And so here, I would just say, well, by that logic, I could pray and say, I'm not convinced. But to ask them, well, why should I, beyond just your testimony, where's the objective evidence I should believe Joseph Smith had this revelation in the early 19th century? So I would say that instead of trying to get to the rebutting evidence, we should ask them for evidence for what they believe and point out that it's insufficient.
Good counsel from Trent. Your podcast.
Council of Trent on iTunes, Google Play. Check it out.
888-318-7884. Let's go to Thomas all the way from South Africa. Praise God. Watching on YouTube live. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Thomas. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi there. Yes, thank you very much. Avid listeners all the way from South Africa.
No problem. How can we help you, Thomas?
So my question is just want to ask Trent to explain how we as Catholics would explain the miracles of Mary to non-Catholics.
What do you mean by the miracles of Mary? Do you mean like the apparitions of Mary?
Yes, and also, not sure the pronunciation, but Medjugorje, where they say she appears.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what I would say first as a disclaimer is that not every claim to Mary having been appeared somewhere has been approved by the church, and some have received disapproval. Medjugorje would be an example of that. But I would say just to the larger question of how do we explain things like Marian apparitions to our Protestant brothers and sisters, I think we should go back to the question of how does God reveal himself? And we can find common ground with Protestants in that way. If you go to the Catechism, paragraphs 66 through 67, it talks about public versus private revelation, that we agree with Protestants, that there, I think many Protestants would agree with the difference here, that God has revealed himself publicly. Now, we disagree about the content of that revelation. They think it's only in the Bible, but we agree there is a public revelation meant for all people, meant for all believers. But there can also be private revelations, things that have been given to individuals or groups, things that are not a part of the deposit of faith. Even Protestants can believe that there's the Bible, but that God could speak to you in prayer apart from the Bible. That if God spoke to you in prayer, it's not binding on Pastor Smith or other Protestants, but God could speak to you. So I think if we can ask Protestants, can God speak to people apart from the Bible in a way that is not binding on all believers? I think many Protestants, Chris, would say, well, yeah, sure.
Yes.
Of course he could. And so there we've got a fertile common ground to say that if God, there's nothing implausible about God doing that, then we could say that the church recognizes that God can do that, and it takes account of the piety and holiness of people who make claims to private revelation. And then sometimes the church weighs in on private revelation, not obliging people to believe it, but saying that you are permitted to believe in an apparition or another form of private revelation, and you are permitted to believe this if it is edifying for your faith. So I think that if you find that common ground there with our Protestant brothers and sisters, they may disagree that about Mary appearing, but then you can ask them, well, look, well, can God choose to reveal himself through one of the saints, through human beings? God can choose to reveal himself through one of his angels, for example. Why can't he make an appearance of a saint to communicate his message to particular people? So I think that that might be helpful. And if you would like more resources just on defending the doctrines related to our Blessed Mother, I can think of no greater resource than Behold Your Mother by Tim Staples. In fact, I tell you what, Thomas, stay on the line or chat with us. Let's get your email address. I know shipping things to South Africa internationally can be expensive. If you give us your email address, find a way to do that.
We'll get you the ebook.
We'll get you the ebook of Behold Your Mother. Glory. So let's try to find a way to do that.
Thomas, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Marcos in Puerto Rico, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Marcos, thanks for putting the Catholic Answers Live app on your phone. An update coming to that soon. A whole new app, really, coming.
Oh. Yeah.
Marcos, what's your question?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
For sure.
I was calling to know what is the reason that there aren't physical descriptions of Jesus in the Gospels? Because I was talking with a Protestant friend, and he told me that it was because in the Old Testament, God didn't allow the people to make graven images of him. So is that true, and how should I respond to that?
Well, that's an interesting question. So the question needs to be, we should not make physical representations of Jesus because there is no description of what Jesus actually looked like in Scripture. And this comes to the question of graven images. Let me tackle the question in a multi-pronged approach. First, why don't we have a description of what Jesus looked like in Scripture? Well, if you think about it, if you go throughout Scripture, there really aren't physical descriptions of really anyone in the Bible. It's just not something that ancient people considered as important as a magazine-obsessed culture like us cares about.
We do know that Goliath was very tall.
Well, and that was important because his stature is an important element.
Part of the story.
Is an important element of why. Though interesting, it doesn't talk about Goliath's ruddy features or all we know is Goliath's height, that he was taller than most individuals of his time, and that he was strong enough to lift armor that weighed many, many shekels. That's all we know. But otherwise, we don't know what Peter looked like. We don't know what Moses looked like. I don't know what Adam and Eve looked like, because that wasn't as important to the sacred authors to communicate to us. Now, we know they're human. And I think what's important, another reason I think that, honestly, Marcos, that the Bible does not include a description of Jesus is that God became man. It's interesting, Chris, we had this this kind of debate about the German bishops said something about this. There was God became man, not a man.
Yeah.
And now that's true in this sense, in that God...
He had a divine nature.
God had a divine nature and a human nature, and he ought not be identified solely with one particular human race, even though, for all practical purposes, we would say Jesus probably looked like a typical member of Palestine in the first century. If I had to ballpark his height, I don't know, 5'3", 5'5". He would not... Now, this is what's funny, Chris. He would not be as tall as people piously believe him to be, that he was this, you know, 6 foot tall, blue-eyed, long-haired individual. Because if he were that high, you wouldn't need Judas to identify him in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Right.
He would say, which one is Jesus? The freakishly tall one. Because we have skeletons of that time, and so we could approximate Jesus' height, things like that. But I think it's important that Christ's description is not in the Gospels, because in God becoming man, we can represent him through a variety of artistic images to show that Christ became man and fully redeemed the entire human race. So, for example, at the Basilica of the Annunciation in Nazareth, there's a wonderful series of artistic images of Our Lady holding, you know, the Madonna and Child. And I love their diverse racial group. You have ones from China, ones from Africa and India, you know, showing Christ and his mother in a variety of racial images to underscore that our faith is Catholic and universal. The one from America is hideous, as you could expect.
Yes.
It's just, I really wish we could get a do-over on that one. So I would say, Marcos, that that's the reason it's not there. Another point to bring up is the prophecy of Isaiah of the suffering servant says that the Messiah would not be a comely individual. In Isaiah chapter 53, it says, he grew up before him like a young plant, a root out of the dry ground. He had no form or comeliness that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So we wouldn't fixate on that. Now, when it comes to the licentiousness of making images of Jesus Christ, what you could challenge your Protestant friends here is to say, look, the Bible never prohibits making descriptions of anything. It prohibits making physical representations of things you bow down and serve as idols. That's what it condemns.
I think of our Lord's instructions in the creating of the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, they carve angels for that.
That's right. There are angels in Exodus 25:18 of the Ark. The Temple of Solomon had graven images on it in 1 Kings 6. In Numbers 21:8 through 9, God tells Moses to make a bronze serpent.
Right.
To heal the people from the serpents he sent to punish them. One question you can ask your Protestant friends is this, who are opposed to graven images. Does your church have two things? One, does it have a nativity scene? Many Protestant churches have nativity scenes, so they have a graven image of Jesus. And then two, even if they don't have a nativity scene, they probably have a cross. And if you read Exodus 24-5, as rigidly as possible, it says there, you shall not make for yourself a graven image or likeness of anything that is in heaven or in the earth beneath, the water under the earth. You shall not bow down or to serve them. Anything in the earth beneath. So you couldn't even make, under the view of saying all graven images are wrong, you couldn't even have a image of a cross at your church if you were 100% against graven images. You could tell your Protestant friends, we both agree you can make images of things important in our faith. We just don't bow down to them as idols. We don't worship them as if they have some kind of magical or salvific power in and of themselves. They are reminders that point us towards the things that they represent. So I hope that's helpful for you, and I'm glad you called in.
Marcos, thank you so much for your call. My friends, you want to tell others about your Catholic faith, but you're not sure where to start. Perhaps you're concerned that you're not smart enough or knowledgeable enough or maybe outgoing enough. Trent Horn, in fact, says you are smart enough, knowledgeable enough, and outgoing enough, and he will prove it to you. Trent, a number of years ago, what is this, about 4 years, 5 years now?
It's a while ago. Yeah. This new course I'm filming for the School of Apologetics will be a retool and big upgrade
an update. But until that's available, you can get our daily deal, Trent's three or his DVD, Three Secrets to Sharing the Faith, How to Talk About Catholicism with Anyone, only $10. Trent, give me the Reader's Digest on this.
Well, that is the approach I teach in how to model questions, how to listen, how to find common ground, how to defend your faith. Even without knowing a lot about it, you can start right away after watching that DVD.
Trent, we recently released a couple, 3 weeks ago, I think, your talk from our 2019 conference.
Yes.
And in my introduction to it, I said that if there's one guy who has it down, that it isn't simply what you know. In fact, you could be very, very good and have a lot of knowledge, but if you don't know how to listen, how to ask the right questions, and how to find that common ground, you won't be successful in sharing the faith. And Trent has really mastered this. So my friends, take advantage of this deal, today's daily deal, Three Secrets to Sharing the Faith, for just $10. You can get it at shop.catholic.com right back after this.
We're here for you. Give us a call today on Catholic Answers Live.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Truth. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett, with me in studio, Trent Horn. We're talking about sharing the faith. Trent, we have many questions. We're going to go to Sheila in Fort Mill, South Carolina, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Sheila, I want you to know I'm very grateful to you for listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, and you need to continue to do that and tell your friends about it. But also, there is a Catholic radio network down there, Carolina Catholic, so you need to tell your friends about that as well. Okay, Sheila?
I will do that. Thank you.
Glory. What's your question for Trent?
Okay, so I have several family and friend members that believe that abortion is one of the many issues, many important issues in the upcoming election, but maybe not the issue. And they often tag me as a single issue voter. Mm-hmm. But so are there, I guess my question is there, I've been looking for official teaching or official documents from our bishops that I could share, the USCCB bishops or anybody, any of the US bishops that I could share with them. Is there any such documents? And if not, where would you recommend that I could direct them to review, like the list of top 5 or 10 issues and how they rank according to consider for this next election?
Sure. Sheila, I wrote a whole article about this, and I'll be covering this with our seminar on faith in the voting booth here on Thursday. But I wrote an article about this because there was a debate at the USCCB on this subject, and the majority sided with the view that abortion, it's been the Faithful Citizens Voting Guide to retain this, that abortion is the preeminent issue of our time. I wrote the article at Catholic.com. We'll send you a copy of it to review. It's called The World's Worst Injustice at Catholic.com, but I'll send you a copy. Anyone else wants to read it, go to Catholic.com and search The World's Worst Injustice. And I quote from the USCCB and the compendium on Catholic social teaching on this issue that abortion, because of the moral gravity of the act, which is the direct killing of an innocent human being, of the youngest human beings among us, the moral gravity of the act and the gravity of the circumstances, namely how unfortunately popular and widespread this evil is, that it makes it a preeminent issue. The USCCB says this. It says, the right to life is the first and most fundamental principle of human rights that leads Catholics to actively work for a world of greater respect for human life and greater commitment to justice and peace. So I think that, and I quote from the Social Compendium, which says, promoting human dignity implies above all affirming the inviolability of the right to life from conception to natural death, the first among all rights and the condition of all other rights of the person. So you could say to your friends, well, abortion is a preeminent issue, not just because of the gravity of the act, how widespread it is, but the fact that it involves the violation of a foundational right. If it turns out human beings don't have a right to life, that you can kill a human being because that human being is problematic for your particular goals, if that is licit, all other evils follow. Yes. If you can kill human beings because you find it prudentially necessary to do so,
what can't you do?
What can't you? Anything comes on the table now. So that's why if we don't get that right, all these other issues that they can bring up, you can say, well, why would it matter? Why would any of these other things be of concern if we can't even get this fundamental evil right?
Yeah, I want to underscore what you're saying here, Trent, because the other things that are thrown up as important social causes, for example, the rights of immigrants, for example, mm-hmm. or something like that, or the rights of the poor,
sure.
none of these things make any difference if we can just kill them, right?
Right. Well, if you can kill a human being trying to go from the womb out of the womb, if you are opposed to immigration, why not kill a human being trying to illegally cross a border? For example, if you're worried about caring for the poor, why not practice social Darwinism? If abortion is allowed, then you have no justification to say that these other evils
are eugenics.
Except for popular sentiment, which is a dangerous thing to ground morality on. So I think, Sheila, what you should ask your friends, ask them, all right, what makes an issue important? Get them to give you criteria for it and then show them how that applies to abortion. So ask them, they say, well, these other issues are important. Ask them, okay, what criteria do you follow? And if they give criteria, then abortion is going to rise to the top of the list based on how widespread it is, morally grave it is, and how foundational the rights are that are involved. So is that a helpful start?
It is, and I think anything that we can get, you know, from anything that you might have from the bishops would be really
sure.
helpful. It's curious as to me as to, I'm curious as to, you know, I understand that they can't say, well, vote for this individual,
right.
but they certainly can recommend these are the critical issues, and I just don't think we hear enough about that.
That's right.
From our leaders.
And I think what we can stand firm on is that as Catholics, we cannot formally support intrinsic evils. If you vote for a politician, I'm going to put it bluntly. If you vote for a politician because they are keeping abortion legal, you're committing a grave sin.
Yes.
That's formal cooperation. Now, it could be the case. Someone could come to the conclusion, well, I'll vote for a politician in spite of the intrinsic evil they defend. That may happen in some cases, Chris, where you have two politicians for an office, and let's say both defend abortion, yet one only defends abortion in hard cases. Here in this case, where if you could be justified in voting for someone who defends an intrinsic evil, if it's the case that it's a lesser of two evils. However, I would say this is not a free card for anybody who supports abortion to erroneously conclude, well, the other guy supports even greater evils. If you are going to support a politician in spite of their view on abortion, the burden of proof is on you to show that the other politician supports greater intrinsic evils. And if it's abortion, I can't imagine really any other intrinsic evil. There is no other intrinsic evil that would be greater than abortion in gravity and scope.
Trent, I don't think you could have made that any more clear.
Hopefully it is, and yes. We'll have even more when I share on Thursday, Faith in the Voting Booth.
Faith in the Voting Booth, my friends, if you're interested in joining us for that, send an email to radio@catholic.com and we'll tell you how. It's for our Major Giving Society's President's Club and Founder Circle, or visit givecatholic.com to find out how to join. Jonathan and Heikil and Marianne and everyone who's waiting in line will get you in the next hour as we continue with Sharing the Faith with staff apologist Trent Horn back in a few minutes. I am Chris Check, sitting in for Cy Kellett. The show is Catholic Answers Live.